Très bien. Je vais donc profiter de ce moment pour présenter notre second intervenant de ce matin, Nathan Wildman, qui est professeur assistant de philosophie à l'université de Tilburg aux Pays-Bas. Ses recherches se concentrent principalement dans les domaines de la métaphysique, de la philosophie du langage, de la logique et de l'esthétique. Nathan s'intéresse tout particulièrement au fondement de la modalité et en particulier à la question de savoir si l'essence peut servir de fondement à la modalité. Il travaille également sur la logique des vérités fictionnelles ainsi que l'esthétique des fictions interactives. Parmi ses publications plus récentes ou très récentes, on compte notamment The Puzzle of Virtual Theft, coécrit avec Neil MacDonald et paru récemment dans Analysis, et son article « Against the Reduction of Modality to Essence », publié dans la revue Synthèse. Son exposé aujourd'hui s'intitule « Against the Epistemology of Essence ».
Merci. Can everybody hear me okay if I just talk like this?
Okay, good.
So yeah, nice to meet you all. I should start first with an apology. This is going to be just flatly in English because I'm not even close to monolingual. I'm still working on English. I'm really sorry. But after that, I should say thank you very much for the invitation. It's been absolutely amazing to be here. I really enjoyed yesterday. I'm looking forward to the rest of today, and I apologize for what's about to happen. So let me start with an anecdote. So this is my friend Mike Raven. Mike Raven is a metaphysician. He works at the University of Victoria. Mike did his PhD at NYU under Kit Fine. Who's the person in the other picture. Let's pretend that that's Mike in slightly younger, happier days talking with Kit in one of their supervisions. So Mike told me once they were sitting around talking about Raven's PhD, and Michael said something about, yeah, I don't see how we can say this. I don't know how to know when an essential claim is true. And Michael reports that Kit turned to him and said, look, we're metaphysicians. We do epistemology last, if at all. So that's kind of the problem that really I'm going to talk about. Because what I'm really interested in more generally is two questions about the nature of essence. So I tend to call them the analysis question. So what is essence? Is it just a modal notion? Is it a primitive notion that we can then use to define essence or define modality? How exactly should we kind of go? And the flip to that is what I call an extension question. So what is essential to various objects? And the talk today is really kind of about how we might even go about answering the extension question. So here's a couple points about essence that I've just dragged from some recent literature. Well, recent, I think Kit's paper isn't that recent, but you can forgive me for that. So here's one from Boris Coment. He says, it seems plausible that table T is made from more than 50% of matter M, in the sense that being made from more than 50% of matter M is part of the necessary and sufficient conditions for being T. He just says this and then goes on and says, cool, so then having more than 50% of this matter is essential to table T. I have no idea why he thinks that's plausible. He just sort of says it and then runs with it. Another one, slightly more famous. Fine says, it's no part of the essence of Socrates to belong to singleton Socrates. Strange as the literature on personal identity may be, it's never been suggested that in order to understand the nature of a person, one must know to which set he belongs. I mean, cool rhetoric aside, why is it no part of the essence of Socrates to be a member of Singleton? What's the justification? I mean, because Kit said so, as far as I know, isn't factive. But, and here's the last one. So in a recent review article, I said, look, hey, here's an interesting question. Could Aristotle have been a poached egg? Lots of people responded with no, because he's essentially human. And of course, my immediate response was, cool, how do we know he's essentially human? Like, what's the epistemology for that essence claim? For what it's worth, I think he could be a poached egg, but that's because I'm an extreme hexaetist. But we'll come back to that at the very end. So these are just three kind of random examples. I'm not picking on anybody here. It's basically just to kind of highlight, like, metaphysicians, we make a lot of claims about essence, and I don't see, and this is what I was trying to get at with the anecdote, I don't really think any of us have much with regards to an epistemic story behind our claims. So my aim here in, well, I hope to just take maybe about half an hour, because I want a lot of questions, is I want to show there's no good epistemology. Like, it's not just that we're not being explicit, it's that we don't have a story to tell. Importantly, I say we here only including people who buy into a kind of Finean notion. So really, I shouldn't say we, I should say they don't have a story. And when I say Finean essences here, I mean, look, you can call it Neo-Aristotelianism, you can call it low-style serious essentialism, some people have called it capital E essentialism. I don't care what you really want to call it, right? The basic idea is that essences are somehow more primitive than, or more fundamental than, or ground metaphysical modality. We'll come back to a little bit more about elucidating that concept in a few minutes. So I don't think there's a good epistemology there. And I think one knock-on consequence of that is that the kind of view of essence I like, which is a modal account, maybe has an epistemic advantage. And the rough thought here is basically like, look, hey, an epistemology for intentional notions is hard, but an epistemology for a hyper-intentional notion is just that much harder. and yeah, that's kind of a point we're going to come back to a lot. So worth just flagging that up. So one thing to note, a background, I guess you can call it an assumption or maybe just a restriction. I'm going to be talking about what's sometimes called objective essence. So that is the essences of particular objects, rather than something like kind or general essence, which is about maybe properties or kinds or something like this. So I'm interested in a question like, Socrates is essentially human. How do we know that if we know it at all? Versus, right, humans are essentially rational. I'm not so interested in this one. I'm interested in these kinds of claims. We'll talk a little bit about the humans are essentially rational occasionally, but the focus will be just on these kind of particular essence claims. So what's the plan? Well, we're going to start off by kind of motivating why we should even care about the epistemology of essence rather than just, say, the epistemology of modality. After we give that kind of motivation, we're going to look at how to do epistemology of essence. So I spent way too long reading the literature on this and ended up kind of overthinking it a little bit. So what I've tried to do is split them into two camps. There's a kind of what I'll call the classical approaches, and really that's just the term I've come up with to say they use some of the approaches we've used in epistemology of modality to try and help us get to essence. So that's what I mean by classical. It's the old ways. The old ways are best. Turns out they're not, right? And then there's some new wave approaches, which I mostly wanted to do because I'm in Paris and I want to talk about the French New Wave. So these are going to be kind of approaches that have been generated in recent essence literature to try and give us particularly an epistemology for essence as something special. Of course, it's going to turn out these don't work either, or at least that's what I hope to show. And then we're going to end by kind of saying, where do we go from here? Tentative answer, just to sort of spoil the ending, is I think probably the best option is to go back to something like a kind of Lockean skepticism. We should say, hey, if there are these big, deep, dark essences, they're just unknowable. And maybe, to make a really bad joke, essentially unknowable. Maybe there's just no way for us to get to their content. So that's the plan. Let's go ahead and start with the first bit on the epistemology of essence. I should also say, too, if I'm talking too fast, because I get excited and everything, it's fun, just flag me down and tell me to slow down. Sorry about that. I realize I'm talking to a room full of mostly, if not entirely, English as second language speakers. So Why be interested in the epistemology of essence? And essence in particular, again, in this heavy-duty Feinian sense. What's wrong with the epistemology of modality? Isn't this enough? Well, one cheap motivation is just, well, there are some epistemologies of modality that explicitly appeal to Feinian-style essences. So they owe us an epistemology of Feinstein-style essence in order to finish their story about the epistemology of modality. So Christopher Peacock is a good example. He identifies constitutive principles of modal knowledge with knowledge of essence. So cool, he needs to tell us an epistemology of essence. Boris Comint is someone who explicitly appeals to essence facts. Again, Feinian essence facts. He thinks they're kinds of metaphysical laws, or they're encoded in metaphysical laws. So again, he needs to tell us a story here. But of course, right, you might think, are there any more general reasons? Well, here's the obvious big one. There's a kind of metaphysical one, right? So essence, at least if Fine is correct, is prior to modality, in some sense of prior, right? So the familiar story, well, I hope it's familiar. I'll go through it quickly, right? There was a view I like to call modalism. It treats metaphysical modality as prior to essence. That is, essence is going to be grounded in or analyzed in or defined in terms of basically de re metaphysical modality. Right? So you have something like this principle ME, where we say, hey, A is essentially F, if and only if necessarily, if A exists, then A is F. And that, you know, you can put the little definition sign under the if and only if. It's supposed to give us an analysis or a reduction of essentiality in terms of the boxes and diamonds, in terms of necessity and possibility. Right? So Fine came along in 1994, and he said, hey, some properties seem to satisfy that right-hand side, but not the left. That is, some properties look like they hold necessarily, but they're not essential. We've already mentioned the most famous example. So the most famous example is, hey, look, let's take Socrates and singleton Socrates. They always necessarily coexist. Whenever you have one, you're always going to have the other. But importantly, says Fine, right? Socrates is a member of singleton Socrates is necessary, but it's not essential to Socrates. Whereas singleton Socrates, having Socrates as a member, is both necessary and genuinely essential. So this kind of has as a member thing tells us something about the nature of the set, whereas Socrates as being a member doesn't tell us anything about his nature. Just remember the quote we had earlier, right? As weird as the stuff about personal identity may be, we don't need to know about what set Socrates is a member of. So Fine's insight is there's a gap between the merely necessary and the genuinely essential. I should also mention, I should have put this earlier, I'm going to talk primarily about properties, and properties being necessary or essential, but we could rephrase all of this in terms of propositions. So I just find the property talk a little easier or more natural. So again, this is Fine's big insight, and this is the reason why we're supposed to give up modalism. There are some things that are merely necessary and not genuinely essential. So, cool. Given this, it looks like we need to adopt a different story. We can't do this analysis of essence in terms of modality. So Fine's suggestion, flip it, right? Have modality be grounded in or analyzed in terms of essence. So you have what we might think of as FE. Metaphysical necessities hold in virtue of essentialist truths or of essences, and then from them you can get possibilities and so on and so on and so on and so on. Right? So prima facie, this motivates interest in the epistemology of essence in and of itself, this kind of metaphysical priority. Well, right, just as an independent pursuit, because if it is metaphysically prior, we need to know about its kind of essence. Or sorry, we need to know about the, we need to have some essentialist knowledge in order to kind of get to the modal knowledge, given this sort of holds and virtue of stuff. Of course, this doesn't actually strictly work, because metaphysical priority doesn't actually entail anything like epistemic priority. Still, though, right, if you accept finite essences, if you have this kind of metaphysical picture in the background, you owe us an epistemic story about finite essences, because you need to tell us how we're going to get the necessities. So even though it doesn't, like, this doesn't immediately get you to this sort of epistemic priority move, you still owe us an epistemology. You still owe us a story about how we know. Okay. The more interesting one, though, the kind of motivation, is an epistemic one. And this is a problem that Anand Vaya and Mickey Waller have called the problem of epistemic modal friction. Sonia Roca Royas, who unfortunately isn't here, which is, well, we'll come to why it's good in a minute, has also identified a similar problem. So this is an issue with lots of views, possibly even all approaches to the epistemology of modality. And we can get a grip on it by just thinking about conceivability-based ones. Well, we can give a version of this same argument for any kind of view. So a conceivability-based one, a counterfactual-based one, a Kripke-style deduction-based one, however we like. So take a conceivability-based modal epistemology, right? So what do we do? Well, we're supposed to somehow use conceiving to get us to what's possible or what's necessary. How do we do that? We construct a kind of imagined scenario or a conceived scenario. I'm not going to be very careful with the notion here because it doesn't really matter. We construct some scenario via conceiving, and if that's then supposed to give us a motivation to get to some kind of modal knowledge, well, we need to have some kind of confidence that our constructed representation is in fact a representation of the scenario we had in mind. Anand and Mickey talk about imagining there's transparent iron, right? What would be involved in this kind of work of conceivability? Well, you need to somehow conceive of something that looks a bit like glass, but it is steel, right? And here's the problem. Merely just saying, oh, it looks like this, but it's steel, isn't enough. Because it could just be that that's the way you think it is, but that's not actually the real facts inside the imagined situation. So here's a comparable case. Suppose we're sitting around and some mathematicians break in and they tell us, hey, they've got a proof for Goldbach's conjecture. We're conceiving this situation. Well, the fact that we've conceived them coming in and telling us that they've proved it doesn't actually mean we've conceived of a proof, right? We've conceived of someone telling us that they've managed to prove it. We haven't actually gotten all the way to the actual, like, proof being delivered in the conception. Another way to put it is, conceivable appearances don't always give you conceivable reality, to make a bad joke, right? So when do we get this confidence? When can we make sure that we're not just sort of mere appearance in our conception? Well, Anand and Mickey say, hey, this confidence comes when we're sure that we haven't violated the nature of the entities in question. That is, we already have to have some kind of broadly essentialist knowledge in order to know that our conceivings, in this case, aren't going off the rails, that they're not just sort of mere appearances, rather than actually tracking substantiveness. So what we end up then is we have to have something like a grasp of the nature of the entities in order to then run this kind of conceivability story. So even if you don't accept finite essentialism, it looks like you've got to have some story here. You've got to tell us how we come to know the nature of the essence, the nature of the objects, in order to then kind of provide the limitations or the restrictions on what is acceptable with regards to conceiving. And again, I use conceivability here as a toy example. We could do it with counterfactuals. We could do it with a kind of deduction stuff. It's all basically the same structure. It looks like essence pops in to provide this kind of friction to make sure that you don't go off the rails. So this motivates thinking about the epistemology of essence in and of itself, even if you're someone like me who really thinks we should just be doing epistemology of modality. So we need something like this at the bottom, at our kind of foundation for our modal epistemology. Okay. So cool. How do we do it? How do we actually do the epistemology of essence? Well, as I said, the way I want to start is by looking at what I've toyingly called classical approaches. And the classical approaches are basically just, let's try and use methods that are kind of familiar from modal epistemology. So here are the five I want to look at. So we're going to do something like conceivability, right? Again, this sort of Chalmers-Yablow move, something like this story we just told a second ago. We might look at counterfactual variation. I think we're going to hear a talk about this maybe later on. A kind of Kripke-style deduction. Again, we'll talk about the details of all of these in just a second. Maybe getting something like essence from meaning. And finally, one that's come up a couple times, I think people mentioned this yesterday, is essence via empirical investigation. So again, all of these, I think, are ways that people have suggested we can get at modal truths. So could we use them maybe to get at like fine-style essentialist truths? The answer is going to be no, just to spoil it. So let's look at our first two. How might we come to the knowledge of essence? We might try conceivability. So in an earlier paper, Anand Vidya, I always butcher his surname. I think it's Vaidya. I'm going to get it wrong. I'm just going to call him Anand because that's his first name, and I know how to say that. So Anand actually, in an early 2010 paper, suggested this as a way to get to essence. So he said, okay, what we do is we take an object and we vary it through imagination, or we vary it through conceptions. And by varying it, what we do is basically imagine it's changing its properties over, say, imagined time. And as long as we keep the object, we know that the properties we're swapping out through the conception are accidental. And as soon as we lose the object by swapping out some properties, we've learned something that's essential to the object. So we hit a kind of limit, we take a property away, right? We lose Socrates. Oh, we figured out that that property was essential to Socrates. And so it's very similar to the kind of conceivability that we talked about a second ago. A similar kind of story, and arguably this is in the Williamson. I'm not going to go out on a limb and say he's definitely buying into this, right? Is we take an object and we run it through a series of counterfactuals, where we imagine, like, okay, imagine this object doesn't have this property, then do we still get the same object out? Does it still exist? Right. And if we can get the kind of counterfactual where losing the property counterfactually entails the thing doesn't exist anymore, cool, we found an essential property. So they're very similar, right? One is kind of doing it in conceivability terms, the other is doing it in terms of counterfactuals, but they're broadly the same project, right? Vary the object through some kind of machinery. If you lose the property and you lose the object, then the property had to be essential. Here's the problem. This isn't going to give us knowledge of essence. That's just knowledge of necessity. Because every time, what are we doing? We're talking about this thing goes away and this object goes away. That's just mere necessity. Or at least, I don't see any reason that justifies going from mere necessity to genuine essential. Remember, that was Fine's big insight. So cool, here's a property. If we take away being a member of Singleton Socrates, we lose Socrates. Thought that wasn't supposed to be essential, guys. What went wrong? Right? So that's slightly overstating it, but I hope the kind of point gets through, right? These methods, as they're written, only ever give us anything like necessities. I don't see any justification in these methods to make the relevant hyper-intentional demarcation that you guys told me we had to make. Right? So the old ways, at least these two ways, aren't so good because they're not actually going to get us to genuine essence. Now, maybe we can supplement these ways, these stories and various options. Again, I think we're going to hear about one of these later. But I think something like this worry is going to constantly come back. Because what's going on here is effectively just modal variation. So cool. If that's all we needed to do, maybe we didn't need Feynman stuff after all. Or at least, I don't see how this can be an epistemology of this hyper-intentional notion. So there's our first two. Here's our second two. And I've grouped them together because Bob Hale bought both of them. He accepted both of them as roots to essentialist knowledge. The first one's actually kind of best exemplified by Kripke. Notably, Kripke arguably had a kind of modal account of essence, so he didn't use this to get to a Feynman story, but we can, right? Where you have something like a conditional, it says, hey, if x is f, then x is essentially f. You have some a posteriori fact, oh, a is f, and then you have an a posteriori, well, what would be a necessity, but in this case is an essentiality, right? A is essentially f. So that's the kind of deduction move. Again, what we need to do then is work out our justifications for one, or the ways we fill out one, and do some investigation to get us to two. So that's the deduction route. Here's the meaning route. This is something also Hale uses in order to justify premise one of the deduction route. He says, hey, knowing the nominal definition of a term, that is the necessary and sufficient conditions for applying the term, suffices for knowing the essence of it. Or at least often suffices for knowing the essence of it. Right? Notably, he thinks this holds even if there is no explicit nominal definition, we just know the essence, the definition, implicitly. So, yeah, what can we say about these? Well, here's the first big problem, and here's why I'm kind of glad Sonia isn't here, because if I get this wrong, she can't get mad at me. Basically, I think Sonia's shown that these two routes don't work. So here's the argument. Some concepts are modally loaded, or maybe even better, we could say they're essentially loaded. So let's say X is a human star, if and only if X is a member of the species Homo sapien. Right? And now let's define up H plus and H minus. H plus, X is an H plus, if and only if X is a human star, and X has its origins essentially. Meanwhile, X is an H a human minus, if and only if X is a human star, and its origins are accidental. Now, here's the really interesting thing. If we find something that's just a human star, we don't know if its origins are essential to it or not. We don't know if it's an H plus or an H minus. Which concept are we supposed to use? Cool. Well, here's the problem. If we assume that origin is part of the definition of human star, well, then we've already had to have had the very essentialist knowledge we're supposedly getting. That is, so take some human A, some human star A, right? In order to know that A is a human plus, right? I'll just read Sonia, right? Knowledge that A is a human plus involves knowledge that A's origins are essential to her. I cannot therefore acquire knowledge of the latter via a deduction that exploits antecedent knowledge of the former. Right? So what's the problem? In order to know that some object A's origin is essential to it via this kind of deduction from it being human, you would have to know that it was supposed to be a human plus. But of course, to know it was a human plus, you'd have to already know that this thing essentially has the origin that it does. And that's the thing that we're supposed to be getting out, not the thing we're getting in. We'd have to assume the very thing that we're trying to derive the knowledge of. That ain't so good. Do we see the circle? Does the circle make sense? Right. So that's a big problem, because basically I think this shows that the deduction move and even the meaning move isn't going to help us. Because if we go back to the meaning move, right, let's think about the meaning of human. Well, is it human plus or human minus? I think it's probably just human star. I don't know which one of those two options it needs to be. And it looks like in order to know that, I would already have to be able to answer my question about whether, say, Socrates is essentially has the origins that he did. So not so good. So I think we can actually give a really fun variant of this. So Sonia puts it in terms of accidental versus necessary. I think even if you grant that it's necessary, it's not enough. This is why I'm actually kind of annoyed with Sonia, because I've given a version of this talking about necessity versus genuine essentialness, and then I read her paper, which was much better. So basically, just we can do the same thing, but instead of saying X's origins are necessary or accidental, just say merely necessary or genuinely essential. use the Finian notion again, that Finian insight, and say, cool, even if you can tell me that it's always going to be necessary, what vindicates the jump from it being merely necessary to genuinely essential? Is Socrates, as we've defined it here, human plus plus, or merely just a human hashtag? I don't see any good way to do that adjudication unless you already have the knowledge, which we're trying to get, that this property is genuinely essential to the object. So we have to bootstrap our way up. I think there's another interesting problem here with the approach of meaning, which is that there might be an issue with meaning change. So this is very tentative, but I think it's interesting, so I'll mention it, right? The meanings, that is, the extensions and intentions of terms, dramatically shift over time. In fact, if you think about English, there's very, very few words of English that still mean the same things that they did even 200 years ago. Some really easy examples. Computer used to be a term for the person who did the computations. Now it's the tool that we use to do them. Salad is one we talked a little bit about yesterday. It used to be a kind of cold, leafy concoction, and now it can be basically even warm things made entirely of meat. Another really fun one is nice. Nice originally meant something like an idiot, and it's gradually come to mean someone who's like polite and friendly. So that's kind of cool. Now, the reason I mention this is if you take meaning change seriously, that is, you think that there's something like a meaning that's changing rather than just simply like a replacement, I don't really see how meanings could be a guide to necessities, because they look like they change over time, and I think very plausibly necessities hold at least eternally, possibly even outside of time. Again, maybe something kind of fun to think about here. So the big issue, though, is again Sonia's problem, which is that if we try and take either of these two routes, we're going to have to bootstrap our way up, and that's not a good epistemology there. So here's the last of the classical ones. Ooh, moving a little slow. So the last of the classical ones is, oh, let's do some empirical investigation. Let's go out and do some science. Science tells us the essences of objects. I don't think that's true. So science is supposed to tell us the essences of objects by, for example, helping us figure out relevant counterfactuals, right? It supports and helps us figure out that it survives certain kinds of counterfactual reasoning, or we figure out how if I wiggle this thing, then it's gonna wiggle these properties further on down, stuff like this. Here's the problem. Again, at best we're getting necessities. I'm not even sure we're getting that, right? But at best we're gonna be able to say, cool, I've shown you that there's some kind of necessary connection here. What's the vindication to jump from mere necessity to genuinely essential? Because remember, that's supposed to be the deep, dark Finian insight. So I can find out that Socrates is necessarily such that if I, say, stop him eating for 20 months, he dies through empirical investigation. Clearly, the ethics board should have stopped me, but still. But I'm not really sure that that's going to help me know that Socrates is essentially such that if I stop him eating for 20 months, he's going to die. I don't know how to make that hyper-intentional extra step. So those are the kind of classical ways, right? The ways we inherited from epistemology of modality. Let's quickly think about the new ways. So the old ways have failed. Let's think about four other options. Our first one might be trying something like inference the best explanation or abduction. Another option is something like conceptual competence. I take this to be slightly different than meaning. But again, maybe this just collapses back to meaning. I'm happy to kind of deal with that a little bit. Another two options deal in ontology. So we might go for maximal multi-thingism. Actually, I think we heard a version of this yesterday or something very close to it yesterday. Or Marc Iago's essential bundle theory. So I want to talk about these four. These are specifically intended to get us just to essence. They're not meant to be ways to go from modality or ways that we use to get to modality, right? They're supposed to just take us directly to knowledge of essence. So here's the inference, the best explanation. So this is something that Boris Coment has advocated for in several places. most prominently in his 2014 book. He says we should use abduction to get us to essence facts via something like metaphysical laws. So exactly unpacking what metaphysical laws are isn't really important for us. What is important is that he thinks they're something like the deep, dark laws about how objects and properties essentially are. So maybe laws about mereology will be in here. Laws about, say, properties being qualitative or powerful or something like this, that's going to prop up in here. Similarly, things about, like, bundt cakes. Does everyone know what a bundt cake is? It's a kind of weird sponge cake. It tends to look like it's got a big hole in the middle, quite squishy. They're not that nice, to be honest. So it's not the end of the world if you don't know them. But suppose you did know what a bundt cake is. Insert whatever cake you know here. All right, so let's read a line from Command. Suppose I'm able to recognize a bundt cake by its look, taste, and smell, but I don't know what it is to be a bundt cake. Don't know its essence. One day, I watch you make a dish that I recognize to be a bundt cake. Insert long story about how you go through the cooking process, blah, blah, blah. I can consequently support certain assumptions about the essence of bundt cakehood abductively. You produced a bundt cake using this method. I know this is a bundt cake, so now I know it's of the essence of bundt cakes to be made thusly, the way that you just did it. Okay. Here's one thing. Even if this is right, at best this is only going to give us a partial grasp in the essence, right? So this is certainly not going to be a complete epistemology of essence. Here again, even if we grant that this gets us to something like, oh, this is necessarily the way that you have to make bundt cakes. Cool, what vindicates the jump from necessarily this is how bundt cakes are made to genuinely essentially this is what bundt cakes are? Right. And finally, I think there's issues about multiple realizability, to come back to a topic also we talked about yesterday, that will lead us back to a version of Sonia's objection. That is, it looks to me like we need to know that this cake is essentially a bundt cake to know that I should apply the essentially loaded concept of bundt cake to it. Because it might be a bundt cake minus, right? Which is one that, oh, it's a bundt cake in this world, in another world it's a Brandenburg or something like this. I could have had the same cake, made it slightly differently. It's still the same cake. Cool, then it's not essentially a bundt cake. I already need to know that it's essentially of this type in order to know that I should apply this apparently essentially loaded concept. But that was exactly the thing that I was supposed to be learning. So again, we're back in the loop. So another suggestion Command makes, and this I take it is also Christopher Peacock's view, is something like conceptual competence. So competence with certain expressions requires knowing the necessary and sufficient conditions for applying them. Competent speakers will then be able to know that if the relevant entity exists, predicate satisfied, it's essentially thus and so. I think similar problems are going to keep coming up, right? Sonia's worry redux comes in. Nothing in the concept human star tells me that a human star essentially has the origin that it does. We already need to know that in order to know that he's one of those instances. More importantly, I think lots of competent speakers have doubts about the necessity, let alone the apparent deep essentiality of the relevant conditions. I think the clearest example here is when we consider things like art or painting or sculpture. So Kendall Walton has a very famous paper called Categories of Art, which makes, say, being a sculpture something that's at least dependent on certain sort of social judgments and social conditions, which are clearly contingent. So you could have the very same object made in the very same way in a slightly different historical context would then be a different type of art, if even a work of art at all. So I think these kinds of cases really, I think you'd be hard pressed to say Walton isn't a competent speaker of English with regards to art terms. So I'm really not sure how to go from competence to necessity, let alone genuine essentiality. Again, the last two options are broadly, as I said, ontological. So maximum multithingism is a view developed by Leslie. Kement talks about it. It's a fun view. So the idea is basically a material object is co-located with a countable infinity of other objects, and the only difference between them is what properties they have that are essential. So let's take the chair, right? The chair has, there's an infinite number of different objects, all of which are co-located with the chair, and the differences between them are just like, oh, one of them has this location, essentially, one of them has this location and this color, essentially, one of them has this location, this color, and whoever purchased it at the time, you can see how this goes. This is a view, and you get essences kind of on the cheap just by simply picking the right object. Well, cool, by picking it, you had to pick the right essence. At the cost of absolute ontological explosion, and moreover, it forces you into kind of semantic ambiguity. If we're talking about Socrates, who are we talking about? It looks like you can't get an essentialist claim wrong. You just say, oh no, I was talking about the other one, the one that has this property essentially. And that's not so good. That makes essence claims too easy, I think. The last version is kind of close to maximal multithingism, and this is Mark Yago's essential bundle theory. So Mark thinks that material objects are just bundles of properties, right? And each property in a bundle is essential to it. So he's effectively a kind of mereological essentialist with regards to bundles. Right? So, and how do we single out bundles? We do so via kinds. So there's going to be lots of different bundles of properties here, and if I apply the kind chair, I pick out one bundle. If I apply the term, I don't know, vaguely Art Deco object, then I get a different bundle, et cetera, et cetera. It's really close to the maximal multithingism, but it's not maximal. I think the problem here is when we think about picking up particular objects, we have to know what's the right bundle. So this is, again, Sonia's problem. I need to know if my origin's part of the bundle or not. Right? And that's what we're supposed to be learning. So I have to know that it's part of my essence in order to know that it's part of my essence. I have to know it's in the bundle. How do I know it's in the bundle? It's part of my essence. Wait, no, that can't be right. More importantly, this kind of conceptualization, I think, again, merely, it only delivers mere necessity. It doesn't get us to genuine essentiality. So, where do we go from here? What have we done? Oh God, what have we done? Right. So, we've gone through a bunch of different options that are meant to be stories about how to do the essence epistemology. And it's been pretty negative, and I should have warned you, I'm a fairly negative person at the end of the day. So, sorry. So, where do we go? Well, I think one option is to go for Lockean skepticism. That is, right, essence, this sort of Finian notion is unknowable. There's no good root to it. Or at least when it comes to a lot of the essence claims we seem to be interested in, there's no way. Maybe we can get to some really simple ones. But for most of the interesting debates, doesn't look like it. Right. Another option is a kind of Armstrongianism. And what I mean here isn't sort of David, but Louis. So presumably people know the famous exchange where a DJ asked Armstrong, like, oh, what is jazz? And the response was, right, if you have to ask, you'll never know. I think this is the kind of response that Kit tends to give me whenever I say, like, I don't understand essence, man. He's just like, come on, come on. So that's a move. That's not a very satisfying epistemology, but maybe it's what they want. Another option is to say, and this is close to the skepticism, but slightly different, is we can say, cool, let's just spot whatever makes it through the problems. And otherwise, let's go either extreme hexaetist, where we basically say, cool, if it's not like one of the few that maybe makes it through the issues, possibilities wide open, go nuts. Right? Aristotle could have been a poached egg. Cool. Right? Aristotle could have been an event. Maybe not. Maybe he has to be an object of some kind. Whatever. Or you go the other way, and you just say, cool, let's go extremely modally fragile. The only things that make it through are the genuine possibilities we can see. Everything else is necessarily and essentially the way that it is. So this is sort of innocent until proven guilty, or guilty until proven innocent, I think, is different ways to think about this. And you might actually see maximum multithingism and essential bundle theory as edging in this way, because they're basically pushing us to go, well, maximum multithingism is just a kind of modally fragile view. We just have lots of very fragile objects. But I'm not sure that any of these are satisfying. I'm sure that the Feynman essentialists have moves to make. I just kind of want them to, you know, I want them to do better, I guess, to be very Williamsonian. Must do better. But yes, so thank you very much for listening. Wrap it up by showing you my dog, who I know is essentially cute. So thank you very much.